Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I am Stash Siokowski.
And today our theme is healthcare news.
Whoa.
Today is Monday, September 25th. And have we got news for you?
Whoa. Oh, boy.
Okay. Tell us about Speak first, Stash.
Well, Speak is coming up. Today is the 25th. And Speak will be with us on October the 10th. And on October the 10th, we're going to have Lynn Forth. And then on October 11th, we're going to have Lynn Forth.
Scariest storyteller in the world.
Oh, wow. And Lynn is going to tell some scary stories. And she's a wonderful person to hear. And to perform with, I've had the pleasure of having her perform at a festival that I ran, and also in Pittsburgh at a festival that I worked with. And I got to perform in West Virginia at a festival where Lynn Forth was the featured teller, and Jamie Frommel and myself also got to be on stage and tell. And one other storyteller who was talking about a school program. But anyway, Lynn Forth is dynamite. I'm really looking forward to it. The Tuesday night performance will be at the place where I can never think of
Reynolds
the name.
Hall.
Reynolds Hall. I should write that on my screen or something. Reynolds Hall. And the Wednesday performance will be at
the Community Club.
Community Club. That one I knew, it just takes longer because there's more letters. You know, it's true. There's 13 letters in Community Club, so that's all.
You know. Okay. They have to go in a particular order.
That's right. Okay. So, and then in November, we'll have Bill Harley, and I'll talk more about him next week. So, and next week will be a new month.
It is, yes.
Fall
is here.
How about that? Next week, in fact, we'll be on the second day of the month when we're recording and stuff. Here we go.
I want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for opening our show with Tarry Here. We always love hearing Andy's songs.
Yep.
So I think you should go first, Stash, because you have a big, big story here.
Well, I do, and I think it's good to. It's good to let people know what's going on. I had a great adventure starting on August 15th. And I won't go through everything from August 15th because that's a lot of days. However, I spent 3 days in the hospital. During my time in the hospital, they discovered that I had a heart block. And I did not know what, I thought a heart block was, you know, stuff got all gooey and stuck up in your arteries or veins or something, and the blood wouldn't go through. That's not a heart block. A heart block is where one side of the heart, which sends a signal to the other side, doesn't do it properly. So apparently, and the doctor explained this to me really, he said, your heart, it kind of takes turns, you know, pumping one side, then the other, and the, you know, that's the way the pump works. And he said, what's happened with your heart is one side is pumped and sent an electrical signal to say, okay, your turn. And he said it in these words, which was wonderful because I could understand it perfectly. You know, he didn't use any of that fancy stuff, fancy talk. And he said, but sometimes it's that signal doesn't get through. And he said, he showed me the results of a 14-day monitor that was taped to my chest after I got, when I got out of the hospital, that I had to send off to a company. And he showed me right on this device, he had a copy of what that monitor was doing. And it showed the screen, you know, and they have the wiggle line going across because your heart is beating and fingers. And then, and he showed me at one particular time, there were a number of them, but during those 14 days, he said, see here, watch. It's going across wiggling, and then all of a sudden it goes a straight line. And he said, we don't want that to happen. So we're going to, you're going to get a pacemaker. Yikes. He said, okay. So, and he said, we'll do it. That was in his office. He said, and I've scheduled it for next Friday. He said, the 22nd, you'll come in at 7 o'clock. At, by 8 o'clock, you'll be all fussed over and people will be telling you what to do. And you'll be undressed and you'll be on the gurney. And then we'll take you to the surgery room and I'll explain everything in detail. And so that's what happened. On Friday morning, I went in and I'd like to give you the, layman's blow by blow for what happened on Friday the 22nd. I at first thought I was going to get, because I'd been told about this procedure. I read up on the procedure and everything. I told that I was going to put two wires down into my chest and into my heart. And those two wires would be embedded in the heart. And in a few days, the heart having these foreign objects in the flesh would kind of build up a attachment to it. And on the other end of the wires, which were sticking out of your chest, they would be attached to a disc that was a power source and a control thing. And they would, I was told where they were going to put the disc. And I said, so they said it was going to be like a pocket. You're going to make a pocket in my chest. Yeah, just very light under the skin. Put the disc in. It'll be covered. You know, it'll be protected and everything. You'll have to be very careful of that. They are not likely happen. It's doesn't happen frequently, but it can happen that you could get an infection. And if it gets dirty or something, somehow gets an infection, then it has to be taken out. And he said, and a new one put in. And I was like, oh, whoa. But then he explained, the procedure I would like to do today, and it's up to you. It's your choice. I said, no. And I even said, excuse me, no, you're the doctor. Why don't you do it? He just smiled. He said, boy, you're easy to get along with. I said, well, I said, I have faith in anytime I'm in the hospital, I have faith in the doctors. So he explained to me that, and he held one in his hand. He had a tiny little device. It looked like a miniature battery. It was a cylinder about half the length, maybe an inch long, but maybe not even that long, no longer than an inch. And it was a silver little thing, cylinder. Had four sharp like prongs sticking out of the end, not very long. And so he said, what we do with this is I'm going to go through the artery in your groin. This will be attached to a device that I will put into your vessel. And I said, oh, I've had five catheterizations during my lifetime. He said, yeah, it's just like that. He said, I'll slide this up. It'll go right up into your heart. And it'll be directed into your right ventricle. Without him explaining anything about that, I got the impression from the way he was talking about it, that it would just go into the right ventricle because of, you know, that's where it was headed. And that's the best way to do it. So That's what he did. And then he said, it'll be implanted there. I will fix it so that those little hooks on the end, barbs, will go into the flesh of the ventricle, and it'll stay there. No wires. It's completely, I don't know if you use the word autonomous or not, but it is self-activated. It has a 15-year battery life, and there are no wires attached to it, because when it's in place, I will release it from the device that I use to get it there, pull that out of your leg, we'll close up the incision. And he said, but before you leave the hospital, I'll take that closure out. He said there are two ways. It's closed from inside. There's a closure, and then there's one from the outside, and the outside closure thing will be removed before you leave the hospital. So he did. The nurse said, you're going to start to feel a little bit sleepy. They had needles in both my arms and IV, and gave me something to relax me. Well, I relaxed really well, because I was not aware of what they were doing. The last thing I was really aware of, and he was still talking to me, was the nurse was shaving me, you know. But she said, by the way, for the next few days, this is going to be irritating because your hair is going to start to grow back and everything. I said, okay, that's okay. I've had that done before. So anyway, after I wake up, the doctor tells me, the surgeon tells me how everything went. He's real happy with it. And then the man comes in the room, and he's just like a doctor, but he's really a tech. Introduces himself, very, very nice man. He said, I'm not a doctor, I'm a tech, and I work for the company that made that device that they just put on you, and I'm here to check it out, make sure it's working properly.
Be safe?
Yes. Okay. I'm recording.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ready, Fan?
I saved the first part, and you should be good with that. Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So this very nice man, the tech from Medtronic, which is the company that makes the device, he gets his iPad out, opens up a program on it, and shows me that the device is working fine, because on his iPad I can see on the screen the wiggly line going across, just like watching an EKG. And then he says, now I'm going to adjust the rate. And he does something on the iPad, a little touch, and the line going across is faster. And he said, I speeded up the device a little bit. He said, that device is set so that if your heart goes under 50 beats per minute, you will get an impulse from that device, which makes it go above 50 and stay there. And he said, so that's how it works. And it's working fine. He said, I can sign off on this and say it's working 100%. And he thanks me, and he shakes hands with me, takes his iPad and goes away. And the doctor is very pleased with it, because I then find out that this is the first one of these being implanted at this hospital. And I think that's wonderful. I have heard of this surgery with other people. In fact, a friend of ours has had it done. So anyway, I'm very happy about it, because he explained everything about it, explain how I should take care of the site, washing, making sure it's kept clean, use a little bit of a certain kind of ointment a medical cream to keep any chance of infection down. He said I can take a shower that very day. So we were in at 7 o'clock in the morning. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Terry and I pulled up in front of Boyd's Diner in Martinsburg and had a very nice early supper.
Right.
And I am feeling wonderful. I feel like I have lots more energy. And I don't know if that's just because I feel happy about the procedure and I feel comfortable about the procedure and I'm not worried. But I feel very, very good about it. And it seems to be doing something. I do feel like I have a bit more energy than I have for many months.
Yeah, so, you sound positively euphoric about the whole experience.
Yes. Well, it was very good. It's very wonderful. Positive. And the staff and everybody there. And to put in a plug for, I know that people in different places, hospitals and healthcare centers are getting a lot of grief lately because they have a hard time keeping up with, full staff but this hospital seems to have it tightly controlled. It actually is kind of the opposite. I was told, and this is twice now, I've gone to the hospital for some, and just go in the main entrance, right at the desk, tell the person why you're there, they will send you, you'll register, and then they will get you right back to where you're supposed to go to the surgery. And I was like, okay, walked in, hi, can I help you? Yes, I'm here, I'm gonna have surgery today. Oh, you wanna go to the cardiac unit, right? Okay, just go right there to room number 4 and they'll register you and then the lady will show you where to go down the hall to that. I mean, it was like, you know, friendly, polite, and on the ball, you know.
Do they have all their specialists who are not directly connected to the hospital? Are they all there as well? Like here in Hagerstown, Meredith is a huge complex.
Yes, this is not as big as Meredith, I don't think. But I've only been in some of the buildings. Mm-hmm. I have been in 3 of their buildings now. And they have them in special, the buildings are not connected like they are in Meredith. You know, there's a sign that says hospital, you know, H for hospital. You go up there and there is the main entrance and there is the emergency entrance around to the right of that, there is a sign that says, direct you to building 2. And across the road from that is building 3. And so they have lots of specialists in those other buildings. I've only been to those 3 buildings, which are all within sight of each other. Now, I don't know for other, I do have a follow-up with my doctor, with the surgeon rather, follow-up with the doctor. Either Thursday or Friday, but that's in Winchester, Virginia. And that's because he has an office in more than one place so I'm not sure if they have everybody corralled. However, even at Meredith, some things I've had done, I had to go down the street,
mm-hmm.
to a different area,
right.
You know, slightly, I mean, not that far, but away from the hospital. And that the big monster building, you know, the first 2 times I ever went to that building, I didn't realize I got lost, which I'm, you know, almost famous for in some ways, but I wound up going to every part of the, you know, from the green to the purple, to the blue, to the yellow, to the white. And I was like, oh, I get it. You only have to, you can use any door and get to where you're going as long as you know where to go.
Yeah, that's the challenge.
Yeah, so, you know,
finish.
No, I was going to say, but it is nice to know that once you get in the building, somebody will be able to tell you which corridor to go down to get to which colored place you need to be. So,
and the more you go, the more at home you feel.
Yeah, it's true.
I wanted to let our listeners know you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. And our theme today is healthcare news. And Stash, I hope that you will give us periodic updates as you further investigate the medical world.
I'm sure I will, since I have at least, I know I have four appointments coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Well, you don't have to tell us everything. But.
No, I'm not going to tell you because in some cases, I'm not even sure why I'm going.
Well, the technology alone is fascinating.
Oh, my goodness. This is so.
Okay.
So are we going to hear from you on healthcare?
Yes, you are going to hear from me. It's likely that if we have anybody listening today, I'm not sure we do, but if we have anybody listening to us today, it's probable that at least one or two have seen, have either heard about or seen the relatively new documentary, Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones. So I am currently totally infatuated with these stories. And the film itself is definitely worth a view. And the stories that are part of that series, there's 7 or 8 episodes now. I'm just going to talk about a few of the early ones today. But consider adding to your wish list, Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones, and prepare to learn more about the centenarians living in much higher than average concentrations in a few specific, small and somewhat isolated regions of the world. So the episodes that I'm most familiar with concern Okinawa, Japan, Ikaria, Greece, Sardinia in Italy, Nicoya in Costa Rica, and perhaps the most surprising of all, Loma Linda in California. And in those 5 areas, more people are living significantly longer than average. However, you don't have to actually move to one of the blue zones to increase the chances that you will reach your 100th birthday. So more on that as the story unfolds. Dan Buettner, the author of the book Live to 100, is the narrator of this film and was instrumental in getting this documentary made. And he explains in the film what these 5 clusters or neighborhoods have in common with each other. Some of these are daily habits and practices of these people. But contrary to maybe your expectations, if you're just hearing of this for the first time, is that these habits and things that people do in these areas are definitely not limited to specific food habits. These communities have a range of behaviors that are somewhat different than the way that you and I live right now. And they apparently have learned the keys to better world health. These are all strategies that can be exported, that can be adapted to other regions, other living environments. Now, Dan Buettner's narrative illustrates the transformations that are possible and predictable with these behavior patterns. This is not a boring classroom film strip. It's a very well-made film, and it includes stories of individuals as well as the villages or cohesive communities that these individuals inhabit. And most of all, the living, breathing belief systems that underlie their daily habits. So the first segment of this series is about a Japanese community in the southern part of the island of Okinawa. And apparently the southern and northern parts of the main island of Okinawa has somewhat different culture and have different levels of exposure to the outside world, commercial influences and things like that. So in this first segment, Dan Buettner, the narrator, presents the four most important factors in the health and longevity of these elders, many of whom are considerably above the age of 100. And these four factors then carry through all of the other environments, all the other communities that are talked about on this video. This is on Netflix, by the way. So the diet of the centenarians of southern Okinawa is very light on animal protein. Their primary source of fish, as you might expect, is fish, but most of their calories come from vegetables, and much of that is raised in home gardens right there in their community. Perhaps even more important to the health of these Okinawan centenarians is their articulation of hara hachi bu. This is a saying that in Japanese means eat till you are 80% full. So this is something that they say to each other regularly. All the children know this phrase. It's reminding them to eat mindfully, to respond to flavors, to pay attention to other mindfulness cues, to chew thoroughly, to pay attention to the smells of the food that they're eating. And that also carries through to food preparation, of course. But the point is to be paying attention and stop when your mind wanders because your stomach is feeling pretty satisfied. When you get to 80% full, that's the number that everybody's taught. Stop, because that's all you need. It's enough. Gardening is an important part of the regular daily physical activity of these centenarians. But they don't speak of gardening as exercise. Instead, they recognize it as a calming influence, a way to center themselves and focus on what matters most. Gardening is a way to provide an alternative to worrying about the outside world and the stresses of modern life. So everybody who was interviewed in this segment, almost all of the older people who live there in this village, spend a couple of hours every single day cultivating plants, growing their own food, helping themselves, helping these elders lower the center of gravity, you know, to help win the battle against gravity as you age, and to practice their balance. They are down on the ground and getting up and down, up and down, up and down, multiple times during those 2 hours. As another way of doing things by hand, of avoiding mechanical replacements, avoiding the mechanization or the automation of life's daily processes, they talk about gardening as both rewarding and healthful, as well as beautiful, that being outdoors in this way is very energizing and nurturing to them. And even more integral to daily health is the habit of walking. So it's clear from the interviews that are done on this first episode and in the visuals that these elderly people walk everywhere. They are being interviewed as they walk. They walk for social interaction. They walk for commercial activities. If they're going to make purchases, they're often walking to the places that they would make those purchases. And they're walking for fun. They walk over to see their neighbors. They walk over to a nearby fellow walker to tell a joke. So these practices, these movement activities, these workouts are not intentional exercise. This is how they live their lives. They are eschewing technology and gym memberships in favor of traditional manual labor and human-powered movement. There's also a concept that these people call ikigai, the Japanese word for personal life purpose, of knowing who you are and what you're doing here, and therefore how you're going to spend your day, how today will go. And this concept, this idea of starting your day with centering yourself in the reason that you're here, is an important part of daily life, taking stock of what brings you joy and how you can serve the wider world. And this theme, this personal life purpose theme, is referred to again and again in different ways, in different languages, as this series of episodes in different places around the world, as this film explores each of the five communities around the globe. There's several different historical religious traditions in the southern part of the island of Okinawa. And the film shares in particular some of the ancient faith practices of the families who were interviewed. The focus is in this community is mostly on the veneration of family ancestor shrines, at least as it's presented in this episode, where people are giving daily prayers for the protection of the family to their ancestors. There's also a lot of discussion in this segment on the tradition for elderly residents, elderly neighbors, to form moais, that's the Japanese word for groups of neighborhood friends that meet for meals regularly, not every day, but at least once a week, sometimes more. But more importantly, support each other in times of need, often pooling financial resources to make community projects possible. Okinawa suffered, particularly hard hit during World War II, and the moais were part of the structure that helped the island to recover and to become successful again. So this theme of cooperation and expanding the family unit to include the larger community, making connections among neighbors to support village cohesion, is evident in some ways in all of the communities that Dan Buettner studied that have a high concentration of centenarians. The next part of the film, or the next little mini episode, takes us to Greece and the island of Ikaria, which is a mountainous area. And this particular mountain village, where there is the heaviest concentration of centenarians, is called Inos, which is high, high above its neighbors, way up near the highest points in the island. And this film tells us that though the island was first settled 2,000 years ago and then colonized by successive waves of conquerors, Phoenicians, Romans, Arabs, and more, eventually the remnants of the original settlers moved to the highest, rockiest, steepest part of the island to live mostly undisturbed thereafter because of their fierce reputation and their willingness to protect these redoubts, their homes, by the sword. And that fierce and principled adherence to self-determination is still evident in the more recent reputation of this village, as this island, as the traditional bastion of Greek-style communism and independent political thought. So some of these ancient traditions continue in politics as well as in dietary habits or exercise patterns. And right alongside that political tradition, old style Christianity is also very visible among the centenarians, with weekly and even daily church attendance for many of them as a common practice. Both philosophical strands clearly evoke the strong sense of personal purpose and community loyalty that characterize these people. And it is no accident that their church is up a huge flight of steps. So going to church every day requires a 10 or 15 minute walk, depending on where in the village you live, straight uphill and then downhill again, which is probably almost as difficult walking down as walking up. And you have these 100 and 110-year-old people just flying up the stairs, running a whole lot faster than I could walk if I were climbing those same stairs. Now, this is by no means an easy life, and the work ethic is intense. Food starts with vegetables and fruits, locally grown, and fish locally caught. The locals are quite clear about the health benefits of each of their local brews, and the local influence of soil and sun and indigenous probiotics that make the difference for them. So wine and the brewing of local teas from natives or native herbs such as rosemary and coffee from neighboring regions are a venerated adjunct to daily social life. There's a whole social environment built around not just food, but wine and tea and coffee. And though people in all of the blue zones work hard and well past the typical retirement age, in our country anyway, daily enthusiastic socializing is also present. And Ikaria is often, and in Ikaria, it often takes the form of communal meals and festivals, dancing, lots of dancing, and drinking together. This is a village that takes unwinding, daily unwinding, and community celebrations periodically very seriously. And one of the lines in this episode is, after all, Dionysius was born and is venerated here on this island. We travel after that to Sardinia in Italy in this film. And I'm going to kind of summarize from here forward in the interest of time, because I do want to get to some pieces from the final episodes. Sardinia is the place where the mountain sides are the steepest, where the villages are tucked away in the most remote places. And organizations, international health organizations, have done extensive research in Sardinia, and they've compared the life expectancy at the lower levels of the island to life expectancy at the upper levels, and the mere fact of having flatter roads reduces, apparently, your life expectancy. Living higher up, having to work that much harder, climbing from building to building, makes a difference. A 10-minute walk straight up a long flight of steps to church or wherever you're going makes a difference. There are also similar dietary patterns and similar connection to family in these villages. There was an episode showing and very elderly, I think she was 97, never married woman, never had children, but she had something like six nieces and close cousins, much, much younger than she, who were looking after her. They said, she is to us like a mother, and so we are caring for her now. She's still very active. She still climbs those steep steps. But they visit her daily. They help with her cooking. They help in her garden. And they are clearly a very close-knit family. And that's not at all unusual in this place. The next visit, the next community is the village of Nicoya in Costa Rica. And there are several people interviewed there. man who's 96 who looks about in his late 60s or early 70s, and the person that interviewed him in depth talks about their shock when they realized that this guy was the guy they were supposed to interview. He came riding in on a horse and was burdened with lots of equipment and livestock, and clearly was a very fit individual. And they said they were, gave him the name of the person they were looking for, and he said, "That's me." And they didn't believe him. They had to go and check his hospital records and check with public health, because they were sure that this could not possibly be the 96-year-old guy they were supposed to interview. We move on to Loma Linda, California. And this was one of the most startling interviews and visuals for me. Obviously, this is in the United States, in California. It's not quite urban by my standards, but it is a very densely populated area, and it's very well, many of these communities are not particularly diverse because these people have been living there for a long time. Loma Linda is ethnically diverse because it is a center for Seventh-day Adventists, and the community itself is only about 100, well, it's maybe close to 150 years old. But they've only become intentionally focused on the health to the extent that they currently are more recently, the past maybe 70, 80 years. And the extent of their willingness to engage in many of the same practices that these traditional societies, these traditional communities are using, such as what the film calls unwinding. You know, people in these blue zones work really hard and well past the typical retirement age, but they're decompressing every day. They're not sitting on a couch Zoom scrolling, doom scrolling, that's the phrase that's used. But they find ways to socialize in community groups. And that's something that the Loma Lindans, the members of the Seventh-day Adventist community, have intentionally pursued. So exercising is often done in groups. Listening to lectures, working on volunteer projects together. All of these things are done with conversation within the community, and volunteering is a huge part of the faith there. So regardless of denomination across these blue zones, people tend to belong to faith-based groups and to devote time to their respective religious groups. In Loma Linda, of course, that's a new tradition, relatively speaking, and they include many of the activities that happen in the blue zones kind of organically. The Seventh-day Adventists have built those intentional social and community activities into their daily life. So waking up in the morning, these people who were interviewed at Loma Linda talked about figuring out their days, figuring out, okay, I know my life's purpose. How am I going to integrate that into what I plan to do today? There are people in this community that have embraced pickleball as a life-giving and community building activity. And there was a doctor, a medical doctor interviewed, who talked about playing pickleball for 3 hours a day with her neighbors, with her friends, because that's how she de-stressed. That was the way that she gives back to her community and encourages her neighbors to get enough exercise. But she's doing it for herself because she loves it. It's clearly a passion. Diet, of course, has always been important to Seventh-day Adventists. And although they do use a lot of what I would call artificial meat, it is basically a plant-based diet, and much of the produce comes from local sources there, and a lot of the people garden there as well, in community gardens as well as in smaller gardens. So eating wisely, you know, carries through all of these communities, and Loma Linda has based much of their decisions on scientific evidence. These other communities often pay attention to the science. It's not that they're not interested in the science, but they're mostly following traditional diets. In fact, according to the film, up to 95% of the diets of these different communities comes from primarily plant-based foods. Protein-rich vegetables, beans, nuts, as well as all of these locally grown fruits and vegetables. Minestrone is named in Sardinia. Beans, squash, and corn is named in Nicoya, the three sisters. And that if you go onto the Blue Zone's website, there's all kinds of recipes from these different communities. Wine is important in all of these communities except Loma Linda, where most 75% of the residents of Loma Linda are teetotalers and don't drink at all. But I was surprised to hear about the importance of wine in all of these other communities. Moderation, that Okinawa phrase, hachibu, about stop eating when your stomach is full. That carries through all of these communities. I did mention placing family first, that is another theme, and partnership, both in romantic unions and with your neighbors, forging these loving partnerships that include marriages. It's not to say that people don't change partners. Some of them do. In all of these communities, there was a discussion of changing partners, but in general, most of the people who are interviewed have partnerships with other family members, either romantic partners or family partners, like these 5 for 6 nieces who were caring for this older woman. The very last two episodes in the series that were really startling to me in a whole different way were Dan Buettner's reports on his work with two very urban and very 21st century communities, Fort Worth, Texas, and Singapore, city of Singapore. But, and both of these city governments, these municipal governments, have put a lot of money after plebiscites and polling the local population. They've put huge amount of resources into developing blue zones. And this has been several years now, and they are already seeing progress. So Fort Worth is collecting data on the impact that their changes have made in the local population's health. And Singapore has basically restructured the city with walkways and collective housing units for elderly people and for elderly people to move their own families into these complexes. So it's an in the visuals are I can't remember the name of those cartoons and space shows we used to watch when we were kids with the air traffic, you know, people zipping around with backpacks on, but it just has that feel. This is a high-rise city, and yet there are parks everywhere. There's walking areas within buildings, green space within buildings, and they're putting money into supporting efforts and families that embrace health-giving activities, health-giving lifestyles. So that's the part of this long series that really gave me the most hope and the most enthusiasm for our capacity as human beings to make a difference in our own lives. And it's not always wealthy places where this can happen. So that's my story.
Are you sticking to it?
I'm sticking to it.
It's interesting. You got to be careful when you, be careful when you go to a place looking for information. Like I went to Loma Linda, California.
Yep.
While you were talking. And
was it a porn site? You said I should be careful. And I know that sometimes when I do .com instead of .org, I get the weirdest
things
pop up on my screen. Okay. Never mind.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking of something completely innocent since since I try never to discuss porn with anybody, even myself. But
good
that's
job,
okay.
Sir.
Yeah. I think so. Things to know, but when I look up something, I always go and take a quick look. Things to know: average age, median age of 36.8.
Right, right. That's true. There's no secret that Loma Linda is a young community.
Okay.
There are people there in their 90s.
Right.
So the demographic, I meant to say that. I'm sorry. I did not say that specifically. Loma Linda is different from these other communities in that the percentage of centenarians there is lower than the other four communities.
Okay.
But they still have a very impressive record compared to the rest of the United States.
Right.
On the age of the people who are active and productive in that
community. And you did make that clear.
Okay.
And this is not, you made that very clear, actually. But my only point is, if someone's listening to us and decides to check and they see average age 36.8, that they may not investigate any further.
Okay. Just the visuals in the documentaries, there are lots more children in the places in Philadelphia, in the places in the United States. And in Singapore are lots more young people visible than in those traditional communities.
So
you can see that the age, just the visual shows you the age.
Right. I know the thing about age. This is me, of course. The thing about age is always fascinates me in that, like in my family, my mother died at 58. My father died at 68. My dad died of lung cancer, a heavy smoker all his life. My mom had cancer, and she was not a heavy smoker, or a heavy drinker. She did drink beer now and then with my dad, and occasionally I remember that she did smoke a cigarette when adults were around, but she never had a pack of cigarettes. And she didn't own a lighter and all that stuff. She would usually bum a cigarette, I guess. But so my parents deceased at 58 and 68. My sister, who did not lead a careful, a careful food eating life. That's not what I wanted to say, but I hope
dietary life.
There you go, an intentional dietary life. But you know, my sister liked some things that are definitely not good for you. She lived, and she was born in 1928, and she lived until 1918. So she lived 90 years.
2018.
Yeah, that would have been a bad segue. 2018. Okay. She lived to be 90. My oldest brother, who was a smoker and was not an alcoholic or anything, but drank a beer and stuff, and did not pay much attention to eating well, lived to be 83. My brother Tony, who lives in assisted living, and you have heard stories about him and stuff. My brother Tony was an alcoholic for many years, smoked for almost probably 55, 60 years. He's more than that, because he's 85. He smoked at least 70 years. And he's 85 years old. He has lots of health problems, but it always has puzzled me. Now, I smoked, but not long. I quit smoking when I was about 36, and didn't start. 26. Anyway, I do drink. I've had alcohol in my life, but I've never been a heavy drinker. I've never been anybody who's had to be carried out of the bar or taken home. And I'm 82. And it just, that puzzles me about how 82, 83, 85, and 90, and our parents died in 50s and 60s. And I think a lot of times people think, and I'm not necessarily one of them that believes this, a lot of times people think that, something about the way your body was formed because of your parents, your DNA and all that stuff is more important than all the other things that you do to live longer. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I've heard of these places in the world for a long time. You know, people have commented on some of these places for a long time, but so I don't necessarily think you're born with a certain thing and you're gonna, you'll live to 62 and that's it, or you might live to 95, but there are a lot of people who think that, and there might be some truth to it. I don't know.
But obviously, we're going to have to talk about this some more.
Yeah, I think so.
But today, we have to end the show.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate all that information you gave today, Fanny. That was, in fact, look at my clipboard.
Well, yeah, but it's the stories. I mean, hearing the individual stories are
yeah. Right.
Well, this is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasi Okowski.
Your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Morgantown, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. Offering our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Case and...
Well, coming up is going to be the Sports and Comedy Attack show with Mike Diesel at
about
a half hour, 40 minutes, something like that.
Sports and Comedy Attack.
The rest of the day is going to be country music of some kind. And
okay.
Well, you know, it'll be a lot of fun. Anyway, we'll have as entertaining as possible as we can be. And,